coming up.
This is a kind of phenomenal discovery in many ways.
Stuart Ainsworth's discovery, which has changed our understanding of a famous ancient site.
The magic of witch bottles, supposedly capable of warding off evil.
And I'll be here with this month's Time Team News.
It's all on the Time Team podcast.
And here we are again with another Time Team podcast on YouTube. And if you are watching and you haven't done it yet, then do check out our other episodes. Just go to wherever you get your podcasts for them. We are now publishing new episodes every single week. We are weekly, and there's always something new to learn and find out about as we unearth, well, various stories from the world of archaeology with our expert guests, including members of Time Team staff.
Yes, and that's where we start this episode, because our very own Stuart Ainsworth has been doing what he does best, looking at the lumps and bumps of the landscape, both using a specialist tool called LIDAR and by going out in the field in person. Now, he's been investigating a really well-known Iron Age hill fort on the Long Mynd in Shropshire in the English Midlands called Bodbury Ring, where he's made a remarkable discovery which totally changes our understanding of the site and how it was used. Now, Stuart's organised a lift there courtesy of the National Trust, so Martin tagged along for the ride.
Stuart! Hello!
Get my belt on first. There we go. Okay, you know where you're going, don't you, Patrick?
Yes! We're off to Bodbury Ring.
We're in the Cardin Mill Valley in Shropshire, which is near Church Stretton, and we're currently going up to look at a hill fort, an Iron Age hill fort known as Bodbury Ring. I'll tell you more about it when we get up there.
All right, get out time.
Whew. Right, Stuart, where are we? What am I looking at? This is a beautiful landscape, rolling hills as far as the eye can see.
Well, indeed, hills is the key word here, because we're surrounded by hill forts, believe it or not, from the Iron Age, across the valley over there. See the big peak over there, Caer Caradoc, that's got a big Iron Age hill fort on it, that one just over the right of the land over there. There's another hill fort up there, and there's another one down there. There are hill forts everywhere on that side of the valley. On this side, there's only one that has been known about, and that's this site called Bodbury Ring, which is on the crest of that hill over there. You can see there's a bush right on the end.
Yeah, at the very top. This is a very sort of, it's your stereotypical ridge, isn't it?
Absolutely. Yeah. And there are lumps and bumps I can see from even here on that end of the hill. But if you follow the ridge to the north, the ridge line, you can see how it's level, a bit of a dip, and then it dips down again at that end. What we're looking at here is an Iron Age hill fort called Bodbury Ring that's on just one end of the ridge, but actually it's only part of what is a huge hill fort that went all the way around the ridge. And that was a new discovery. Up to looking at the LIDAR and up to coming out, all we knew about were the lumps and bumps right on the left-hand side of that ridge up there. So it's a new find, it's exciting, it takes us into a whole new dimension of what was going on here in prehistory. Know about all the big sites over that side of the valley, but there wasn't one on this side, and that's the real excitement of all this, what's going on over here.
Right, well, let's get up there and have a quick look at it.
I had to walk this first time I came around. We have to go through a golf course, bizarrely.
Really?
That's why all these people are here with golf carts and so on. We actually will go across a golf course to get to the hill fort.
Nice.
Where I'm sitting at the moment is almost kind of one of the crucial parts of the hill fort complex that has raised all the excitement, because I'm sitting on the edge, this slope immediately below me is the edge of the earlier hill fort coming round, the following the contour here, and off to my left it's being met by the ditch and rampart of the later hill fort. And what we have at this point is a physical relationship between two lots of earthworks. And it's very, very clear that the ditch that goes with the later, smaller hill fort cuts straight through this earthwork, which we can see going all the way round the contour of the hill, of the bigger hill fort. This is a clear and unambiguous stratigraphic relationship, is a complicated term we use, but basically can see that one thing has cut through another, and that that thing that it's cut through must be earlier than this ditch. It's such a rarity in many ways to find a monument of the scale of this out of the blue, but it does show what can be done with things like LIDAR. You don't always find something like this. When I came up here, I mean, it could have turned out to be absolutely nothing, but to find that what you saw on the LIDAR, it's actually got physical reality in, and there are relationships like that stratigraphy we can see above ground, is the icing on the cake. And as you can see, just how steep it is off the drop there down into the valley below. Clearly, at the end here, when the smaller hill fort was being refortified, it's almost like my thumb, if I can characterise like that. If you can imagine that the earlier hill fort was the whole of my thumb going around the contour of the hill, at some point later on, probably at least 1,000 years later, in the Iron Age, just the tip was cut off with this ditch here and a rampart built round the edge to create this very, very small enclosure on the end. And all around, it's steep slopes, it's easy to defend, very dominant in the landscape, even still. But the bigger one was at least 6 times bigger than the later one.
Thanks to the research that Stuart's done, we know so much more now about this incredible site. But what do these new revelations reveal about what would have been going on here?
This was here for almost political, territorial reasons in the first place. Rather than it being purely a settlement, it was to make a big impression on the landscape. And that tells us something we didn't really have any concept about when we just thought this was a little, tiny little hill fort on the end that didn't have that same presence in the landscape. It's now pretty obvious that this is a place that was chosen deliberately to dominate and to express itself in the landscape.
It's at this time of year that I feel the most jealous of those who can get outside to do their research. And here I am, sat at a desk. I mean, looking at amazing objects, yes, but still sat at a desk. That is such an amazing landscape, isn't it, Martin? I mean, I don't know that part of the world at all, but it looked to me more like Wales or Scotland or somewhere. I mean, properly mountainous, really beautiful. But it is so remote, isn't it? And it's so bleak in a way. And what was life like? I mean, how once you were up there, how do you do just really everyday things, just like getting water and so on?
That's so true, isn't it? If you were going to get water, you'd probably have to walk all the way down it, load up your buckets or whatever it is, and then take it all the way back up to the top. I think the practicalities are worth thinking about as well. Really interesting to see. And of course, great to be with Stuart and get his understanding of the landscape as we walk through it. Really interesting stuff. And thank you, Stuart, for that. If you, by the way, want to see more from Stuart, we actually recorded an exclusive Patreon video whilst we were there, whilst we were on the top of that ridge at Bodbury Ring. And Stuart gives loads more additional insights. It is well worth checking out on Patreon. Whilst you're there, you might be interested in the extended interview we had with Archaeologist of the Year, Professor Joyce Tilsley, OBE, who is an Egyptologist at the University of Manchester. She was on one of our previous episodes where she was basically just a mine of really interesting information about ancient Egypt and what life was really like for, you know, the majority of people, not the pharaohs and all that, people who really lived the real lives of well, you know, peasants, I guess you'd call them, in ancient Egypt. All of it was so interesting and it's all there. So if you want more, get onto Patreon right now.
This is the Time Team podcast with Martin Williams and Helen Geek. And Martin, we really need to talk about the Standing Stones, don't we?
We really, really do. If you haven't watched it yet, I'm sure you have. It's there for you on YouTube, our episode, The Mystery of the Standing Stone. This is where our expedition crew, so a really tight-knit, close, small group of Time Team experts, went out into the forest, essentially, into the middle of nowhere. It was in the Peak District, vaguely near Matlock, and they uncovered this standing stone, and it had been known about for a little while, but what they wanted to find out was whether that standing stone was part of a group of other standing stones, whether it really was ancient or whether it had just been put there by Victorians or something like that, and then what more could be discovered about what it might have been used for. And the team worked on site. They slept there as well overnight. They brought all of the expertise in. They did archaeology in the field, and they got some of the answers to that question. Beautifully shot as well. Some of the views, amazing. And I got the chance to actually catch up with Lawrence, of course, Lawrence Shaw, who led the project, and also Naomi Supor, who was part of that expedition team, after the episode had gone out, for a bit of a debrief, really, on exactly what went on. And here's just a little snippet of the conversation that we had that you can see in full over on Patreon.
We are completely confident that our standing stone that we visited, that brought us to the site, dates to the early Bronze Age, so around 1700 BC, somewhere around there.
Let's talk about your breakthrough. Explain what it was, and also, I mean, how you're feeling about it, because I know that we've been talking, and you, every time it sort of comes up, what you managed to achieve, you've got a big beaming smile on your face. So just explain about the dating that you were able to do, and the breakthroughs that you had.
We had initial indications on site with the bucket flotation method that there could be wispers of charcoal in there. So I was like, brilliant. Brought the soil back, process, like you do. Starts going through everything with tweezers, and there's just nothing. Lawrence says, right, focus on these two areas. So, you know, underneath the stone and where the platform was, because this is where we really need the date. So, yeah, so as you do, you spend hours picking through with the tweezers and toothbrush. And I was actually on a video call to my friend's little boy in Ireland. And he's like, what are you doing? And I turned the camera around. I says, oh, I'm looking for some charcoal. We need to do a radiocarbon date. And he's like, yeah, he knows all about radiocarbon dating. Anyway, as I was chatting to him, a couple of tiny pieces appeared. And we were both like, yay. And then, then Lawrence called me. And I absolutely couldn't believe it. I'm surprised you couldn't hear me shrieking before you didn't need the phone. I was just so excited. And to get that date as well from something so, so small, it just proves that what environmental archaeology can do and how persistence and perseverance, pays off.
Of the two sets of dates that we sent off, one was from around the stone and one was from the watery fields that were underneath the stone. And they both came back within 2 years of each other, around 90% accuracy and assurances. So literally, not only did it seem to take forever, there was just everything seemed to be not going in our favour and just not going to work. And as great as the dig was, we needed the carbon date to really just pin down our assertions.
That was Lawrence and Naomi, and that really is fascinating stuff, isn't it? And it seems to have gone down really well, that episode. I think people like that small expedition crew feel. It's just a few people with really pertinent skills going out to answer a small question in a way, but also, in a way, a very big question. I mean, what amazes me about that site is that, and standing stones in general, is that they've been very obvious in the landscape for so long, and that yet there's still questions that we can ask, still some really basic research that hasn't been done.
And more still to do, I think, at that site exactly. And I think Time Team's going to be going back, which is really, really exciting. So watch this
space. Yeah, well, I hope
space.
I can go next time.
Yeah, that's it. I want to go.
We all want to go.
I want to go. And I've heard that Derek's scrambled eggs that he makes in the morning are absolutely legendary as well. So I want to be trying them as well. Yeah, if you want to see that episode, it is, of course, available for you there on YouTube. If you want more from that debrief conversation. That was just a little snippet of it. There's loads more. The full thing, we talked for about half an hour, goes into loads of detail. That is for you there on Patreon.
Hi, I'm Danny Wootton, having a look at the archaeological stories making the headlines. The discovery of around 800 Iron Age objects in Malsonby in North Yorkshire in North Britain is being hailed as one of the most significant Iron Age discoveries for understanding Iron Age society. The hoard was originally discovered by metal detectorist Peter Heads, who contacted Professor Tom Moore at the University of Durham. Now, there's still a lot of research to do, but they think that the finds date from the early to the mid-first century AD. And there are all kinds of items, including horse harness equipment, bridle bits, and there are even metal tyres to go around wagon wheels. And it's thought that there are up to 7 wagons and equipment for 14 ponies included in this find. And interestingly, they think that the wheels, the tyres for the wagons, might actually be for 4-wheeled wagons rather than the 2-wheeled wagons or 2-wheeled chariots that people often imagine. Now, these finds might look corroded and faded now, but you have to imagine what they must have looked like when they were new. The metal would have been really lovely and shiny, and the intricate artwork of twisting, turning spirals would have looked really stunning. And you've got to imagine as well that some of these finds included coloured glass, so they would have glistened and sparkled in the sunshine. This time capsule is really going to help archaeologists to understand life in northern Britain during the Iron Age and its links to the wider world. Now for an update from a previous Time Team news item about the ancient site underneath British literary great Thomas Hardy's garden. We previously reported that the site had been scheduled as an ancient monument, meaning that it's protected by law. But we now also have some recent radiocarbon dates to report. So the site is known as Flagstones in Dorset in southwest England, and it's 100 metres in diameter. It's a circular ditched enclosure, which is very similar to the early phase at Stonehenge, way before the triglyphs that we're all familiar with were put in. And because of the similarity of this ditched enclosure at Flagstone and Stonehenge, it's thought that the sites were contemporary. Now, the early phase for Stonehenge is dated at 2900 BC, but recent radiocarbon dates from Flagstones, where they used samples from red deer bone and charcoal taken from the 1980s excavations, have been dated much earlier. And the date that they've got for that is 3200 BC, so we're looking at 300 years different. So this begs the question, does the early phase of Stonehenge need redating, or is Flagstones an early prototype for this type of monument? Now, in your kitchen, you probably have a chopping board for chopping up food and may well have a pestle and mortar for grinding up things like herbs and spices. For thousands of years, indigenous people in the Americas have been using similar utensils for processing food. So there's the mano, which is a bit like a pestle. It's a handheld stone. And the metate, which is a flat stone, or often a depression ground into a rock surface over time. And some of these are over 15,500 years old. Researchers from the Natural History Museum of Utah took starch samples from the uplands of the Warner Valley in Oregon, where the metate features occur in outcrops of basalt alongside hundreds of petroglyphs alongside the lakes and streams. Researchers were able to extract the starch granules and identify the different types of plants that they'd come from. Many of them came from the carrot family, including a plant known as biscuit root. And there are also examples of wild grasses, likely the wild rye. Now, many of these plants have been used for hundreds, if not thousands of years by indigenous populations. And interestingly, many of the plants still grow in the areas today. Well, that's the news update for now, and I look forward to seeing you next time.
Now, last week, I went to see a play at my local theatre in Bury St Edmunds called A Trial of Witches, and it's about the notorious Bury St Edmunds witch trials in the mid-17th century. And it follows hard on the heels of another event that took place in Huntingdon last month, and that was a reenactment of their witch trials in 1646. Now, they became a cause célèbre at the time because of the methods that were used by one of the witnesses, the witch finder general, so he called himself, Matthew Hopkins. And he used some fairly unpleasant methods to extract the confessions. And so Huntingdon was a bit of a turning point. But I thought, really, I ought to find out more about witchcraft and why it was taken so seriously in the 17th century. And really, the only thing that I have known about it up till now is that the Portable Antiquities Scheme have recorded a few of these weird things called witch bottles. And one turned up last year, again, in Cleethorpes, when some builders were working on a house renovation. They found this sealed bottle in a 200-year-old wall that they were knocking down. Now, imagine their glee when they realised that there was liquid still inside and they were planning to taste it, thinking that it might be centuries-old, beautifully aged rum. Luckily, they called in the experts before doing that, because the experts informed them that the mystery liquid was actually urine.
They dodged a bullet there, didn't they?
They did. But the question remains, you know, why or how does weeing in a bottle and building it into a wall, how does that protect against witches? What was the magical power that these bottles had? So the best thing I thought to do was to call in an expert ourselves. And that's why today we have with us Nigel Jeffries, who's an expert in ceramics at Museum of London Archaeology. Hello, Nigel. Lovely to see you.
Yeah, hello there. Yeah, both. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much for having me on your podcast to talk about this fascinating subject.
Well, fascinating it most definitely is. Can we start with the basics here and just set the scene, really? What is a witch bottle?
Well, a witch bottle, I'm going to use the description here, more or less verbatim, from what the Oxford English Dictionary tells us. And the Oxford English Dictionary says that a witch bottle is a stone or glass bottle which is filled with prepared contents such as urine, nails, and pins, and then heated and boiled and buried in order to sort of break a witch's hold over their victim. It's worded something in those terms. And I'm sort of part of a project at the moment which is researching witch bottles in the English context. And I've done this through getting some national funding from the Arts and Humanities Research Council. And for about 4 years, 5 years now, we've been researching these kind of fascinating bottles, really. They have nothing to do with witchcraft or witch trials in terms of the reasons they are created. Witch bottles itself is a term which we can find no evidence for as being any earlier than 1844. So it's kind of a bit of a Victorian construct. So they're kind of created as a result of a diagnosis which has been given by sort of travelling healers known as cunning folk. The cunning folk then would prescribe using a cork and stoppered bottle. They then instruct their client to like fill it with urine, nails and pins and so on. Boil it or heat it. If the bottle then, as a result of it being heated, explodes, the witch dies. In some cases, if it doesn't work, then you're supposed to bury it. And so what we find is the evidence of the buried ones, rather than ones which have exploded, which presumably would leave no trace in the archaeological record for us to find in the present, we're finding the buried ones.
If you successfully work this witch bottle magic, and the witch is harmed by what you have done, but they don't quite die. But say somebody coincidentally falls ill in your community, are they then vulnerable to being outed as a witch? Does it have a link to the witch trials in that way?
No, but it has cunning folk, and indeed some learned physicians, put themselves under scrutiny. So cunning folk as a practice was an illegal trade. The blurred boundaries between what either a learned medical practitioner, a proper doctor, as we'd understand them in the present day sense of the word, and cunning folk, what they kind of practiced and instructed was often incredibly blurred. So sometimes some kind of quite famous individuals, Nicholas Culpepper, for example, the herbalist, was, tried because they thought he was a practicing, not a practicing witch, but was going a little bit kind of close to the mark.
Gosh.
In terms of what he was offering as his prescriptions, and witch bottles are just one of many, many cures for bewitchment, which go back to the medieval period. But here's the critical thing, do not survive for us to find in the present.
So a better word might be medicine bottle.
There's no real kind of sense of how contemporaries refer to them. They sometimes refer to it as the urine experiment or the urine experiment.
That's
or,
something know, completely different that we don't need to know about.
Yeah, I can't have a book which is called The Urine Experiment. Nobody would understand that. Witch bottles has become such a kind of fixed term.
It would be in a very different section of the library, wouldn't it? I think that's a good point on which to end this conversation, because it started at urine and it's ended at urine. And some fascinating stuff in between. Nigel, I've got so many more questions about witch bottles now, so we maybe need to revisit the topic on another edition of the podcast. But thank you so much for coming on and telling us almost, I think, everything we needed to know.
But you're right. So much more to say, but I hope I captured everything okay there for your viewers, for sure. Thank you.
Every week, we ask our Patreon supporters for any burning archaeology or time team related questions they may have, and I do my best to answer them.
And we've had a few come in from Patreon supporters. And if you want to do this, by the way, do head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial and comment on the post about this podcast, and you can ask your question, whatever it may be. Let's get to some of these then. The first one comes in from Wessex Wyvern, and it says, I wonder if there might have been more female leaders in Iron Age Britain than we know about. Interesting. The only two that I recall hearing about are Boudica and Cartimandua. We seem to have relatively few names for even male tribal leaders of that time. So why should we be surprised at female leaders when for most of the time we have no idea who the leaders were, only what the Romans tell us? So basically, Wessex Wyvern is asking, why don't we know more about Iron Age leaders, be them male or female?
Now, that's a good question, because we know about some Iron Age leaders from the historical sources. That's the Romans generally writing that down. But we also know about others from the coins. So that's them writing their own names, so to speak, on coins. So that's a native source, a source of them telling us about themselves. I think that having two female leaders that we know about from history, not they didn't issue coins, but I think knowing about those two is actually quite a high proportion of the ones that we know about from history. I mean, I haven't counted them up, but there can't be more than about five or six that we know about from historical sources. If you look at the raw numbers, yes, it doesn't look like very many. If you look at the proportion, it does look like far more. And I think that building on that and on what we heard the other week about the matrilineal, matrilocal tendencies of Iron Age societies, we're looking at a situation rather like the late medieval Tudor period, where not only could women take over the jobs that their husbands had when they died or were incapacitated, but also leaders could take over those roles if, like, for example, Margaret of Anjou, when Henry VI is incapacitated, she takes over, she runs the army, she does everything. Catherine of Aragon, when Henry is away, she appears to be running things at the Battle of Flodden and so on and so forth. It's always that they're doing these things because there's a man standing behind them who's not quite there. If there's a man there, he gets involved. But women are obviously totally capable of doing this. It's just that they don't do it if they don't have to. I think that's the way we should look at it, so that we should bring the women back into the way we look at Iron Age society. Okay, we don't always know their names, but we shouldn't, every time we do a reconstruction drawing or something like that, we shouldn't just assume that it's a man who's doing everything. So a great question.
A brilliant question. Let's go to question number two, shall we? And this one comes in from Michael. Hi, Michael, who says, do archaeologists ever look for clues in language? This is so interesting. And I'm fast becoming very interested in kind of etymology in general because of another project that I work on. And so this is right up my street, this question. I read that the Spanish word caro, this is Michael saying this, I read that the Spanish word caro is derived from the Celtic language and referred to a wooden cart or chariot. In English, it became the word car. That's fascinating if that's true. Someone who built or repaired carts and chariots was called a carpintero, which became, of course, our word for woodworker, a carpenter. Does tracing words like this help build a picture of how cultures moved and mixed?
Absolutely, I think it does. Now, archaeologists are not traditionally that great at looking at anything that isn't material. We're not historically that great at looking at words, but we do have to study things like place names, so we do sometimes begin to turn to etymology. And like you, Martin, I also have a bit of an obsession with etymology. And when I got my first smartphone, the first ever app I downloaded onto it was the Online Etymology Dictionary, which I consult about 4 times a day. Whenever I'm bored, I just think of a word that yesterday's word was forlorn. And I was thinking, forlorn? Why is it forlorn? What does lawn mean? There's lovelorn. Anyway, and I went down a rabbit hole there. Yes, I don't know whether that says anything about the day I was having yesterday.
I know. Of all the words, forlorn. Yes.
But the one before that was actually, weirdly, it was actually carpenter. I've been looking at carpenter too. And that's because I've been thinking about the Sutton Hoo ship reconstruction. And we keep calling our people who are making the ship shipwrights or carpenters, woodworkers and so on. And I thought, well, carpenter, yes, that's obviously a word that's come to us from French. What did the Anglo-Saxons call that job before we got the French word carpenter? And it turns out to be tree wright. In my searches, I, like Michael, discovered that caro, yes, from the Celtic language, and it made its way into French, and that's where it came to us, around 1300. The tool that we need to use this knowledge is the dating. We have to know when a word moved from Celtic into Spanish, from Celtic into French, when it came from French into English, and that tells us when this mixing was happening. So it's really nice to have a French word that's come from Gaulish, a Spanish word that has come from whatever the Celtic variant was that was being used in Spain was. I'm getting a bit towards the limits of my knowledge here. Having that kind of knowledge helps us remember that Spain wasn't just an empty country that the Romans poured into and brought a Romance language. It reminds us that there are other people there too. And I think what language does really well for archaeologists is it shows us the complexity. It reminds us that we can't just take simple explanations that pots move by themselves or whatever, that brooches come streaming in from the continent, or that coins move. You know, it's all people, isn't it? It's all people speaking languages. And that kind of thing really helps to add some richness to our interpretations.
Really does. Thank you so much for that question. And I think we need to speak to somebody who specializes in etymology and how that can help archaeology as well, because I think both of us would just geek out actually during the entire conversation. I think
that would be like the 4-hour long podcast that would end up.
Would some severe editing I think would be needed there. That is it for the questions. There's going to be loads more though on next week's podcast. If there's something you've always wondered about, there's no, you know, silly or ill-informed question. It's any question is allowed. We are going to do our very best to get you an answer. You head to patreon.com/timeteamofficial. Join our community and you can comment on the post that is advertising this podcast with the bonus Stuart Ainsworth chat in there. And we will definitely see it.
It's as simple as that. Now, we're pretty much done here for another week. If you're watching us on YouTube and you want more from us, then make sure to find us where you normally get your podcasts.
Yes, please do that. Next week, Helen is going to be answering more of your questions, ably assisted by a very special guest.
Yes, Time Team presenter Gus Casely Hayford, OBE, will be joining in the discussion. And that's going to be really wonderful, isn't it? Because Gus brings this whole new dimension to Time Team of the art historian. And he gets the kind of the beauty of what we do in a way that just nobody else does.
I'm really looking forward to it. Unfortunately for Gus, though, he will only be the second OBE to appear on the podcast. guest after, won't he?
That's
after Joyce
true.
Drizzly,
That's
who we
true.
Had,
yes.
who we had the other time. So I'm sorry, Gus, you didn't quite manage it that time. Really looking forward to that next week. And if you've got a question, Patreon is where you need to go to ask it. We will speak to you again another time on the Time Team podcast.